All right, I'll go ahead and introduce our speaker for today. Have with me Adam Wolf, who got his bachelor's degree and master's degree in engineering from the University of Minnesota a while ago. Currently, he's at a company called Punch Through for the last three-ish years, and they provide electronic design services. And also for about the last 10 years, he's been running his own company called Lane and Lane, doing electronic design. So with that, I'll let him take it away for today.
So I gave this abstract, Devin, instead of talking about this, and I think I'll be kind of close. So today, it's easier than ever to make electronics. The skills you need are easier to get. The tools you need are cheaper and easier to work with. And the even like the technology, like to just like order stuff and get it built and sent to your house, is more than ever before. And the opportunity there is nearly endless. That's combined with folks in business who want electronics and everything, but they don't necessarily want to pay engineering salaries for like have staff engineers for individual products. And more and more things get electronics in them, which makes everything wants to have electronics in them, kind of like peer pressure. So there's this market opportunity for the fact that it's so easy to make electronics these days, and yet everybody wants electronics in their thing. Everybody wants, I think, to hook up to the internet or to even hook up to your phone. And what that means is that there really is an opportunity these days for a person to do electronics as an individual or in a team of 3 to 5 people and really do products. I mean, they're not iPhones, but at the same point, they're real products and not just toys. So that kind of service exists already in industry. It's called like engineering design services. And I've been in that realm for about 10 years, and it's changed dramatically from where it was. And when I was in school, I had no idea that this existed. My after undergrad, I'd go into a large engineering firm, and I'd sit in a cubicle, and I'd work on a project for 3 to 10 years and be really super awesome at that one project. And in my career, it's been anything but that. So I think with that, we'll move on. And the beginning will seem a little biographical, but at the same point, like I really live being an engineer. So me explaining who I am and me talking about engineering, sometimes I'll just say things. So how do you do if I was kids? I'm older than I look. I am in my mid-30s, but I will start with something that we'll see how far I've judged this or how accurately I've judged this, but that's Bessa from Doomtree, and I have done products with her, so that makes me kind of cool, right? You know? Does nobody know who that is? Okay, so go on Spotify or whatever, and like, enter her name in and she makes some rad tracks. Anyway, so I need those glowing some stage effects for her for like a blowout event she did for the end of a project. And there were these wirelessly controlled chest lights and like an effect on in her mouth where she was wearing like an LED and battery on her teeth inside with like a ring switch, and then she had gloves and magnets in them. And then was able to modulate the light in her mouth while she was singing with her hands. So that's kind of cool. Anyway, so during Lockheed Martin, I out of undergrad, I said I'm going to work in an engineering firm. So I did. I worked on a bunch of projects in my time there. I was in the engineering ELDP, which was a leadership program. So what that meant is that every 6 months I would change which project I was in, in contrast to normally work on a project for a few years at Lockheed. And I did that for 3 years. There was both like the work on projects that I had, but then also there was about maybe 10% of my time was spent learning about engineering and leadership and how to architect projects and how to break projects down and how to work with project managers and get things done in an engineering team. It was super valuable. It was pretty stressful.
And when they closed the site down in Eagan, like in Indianapolis, where I worked, I had a choice of relocating or not. And I really liked Minneapolis, and I was a little burned out at the time. So I said, no, I'm going to find something different, but no thanks. So at kind of the same time, a few of those rotations were primarily like Microsoft Project and PowerPoint. Rather than I had just spent 4 years learning about microcontrollers and learning about electronics and programming, and was really excited to do that. And some of my rotation was talking about doing that or thinking about doing that or planning that much more than actually, you know, like doing the engineering. And so a friend of mine from undergrad who was at and I, we said, let's just make electronics toys for fun, and we'll see if we can make a business out of this. So we threw, I think, we played around with like some Arduino stuff, and one of the things we made was a toy that when you tap the speaker on it, it would actually read your taps, and then figure out a beat per minute or like a complicated pattern, and then just start playing on that too. And we showed that off to a few friends, and a few people were like, how much is that one? I want to purchase that one that we have. Like, this is the only prototype, so we're not going to sell it. But we threw in, I think, $300 a piece, started the company, and said, you know, we'll buy enough parts for $800. And if this doesn't go well, we'll just have a lifetime supply of microcontrollers and buttons. And if it does go well, well, then we have business. We did that about 10 years ago. And I mean, it isn't something either of us work on full time. It's a 19-year-old for a farm thing. But we provide, I mean, it's profitable. It's been profitable almost every year. And it could be more than ramen profitable, which is something we hear sometimes about startups, which is where if we had to make this on anything, it wouldn't be a disaster. Which is a real nice career kind of backup, where when I go into conversations with my boss at like a day job, I know that like if this goes completely south, I have this fallback plan that works, which is kind of really awesome. So one of the projects we made, I think probably my favorite product we've made, is a thing called Blinky Grid or Blinky POD. So these are an array of LEDs here. You've got a micro and almost nothing else except for light sensors up at the top. So we have a website that you can see this girl here is kind of holding the micro, like the whole board up to her computer screen, and you can reprogram the microcontroller optically through some JavaScript on this web page. And you can type in a new pattern and a new program, you hit a button, and then it tells you to hold up to the screen, and then you press the button and reboot the microcontroller, and then it's in the bootloader, and then it reads the light pulses. There's like a data line and a clock line where, and we read it in, there's a checksum that goes through, and then it burns the new program and the storage. That product is our most popular product by far. It got picked up by like Radio Shack and Barnes and Noble, and we were selling tens of thousands per month for a while, which was a pretty exciting situation. After I got off the phone at Radio Shack the first time, I went back to my wife and said, you know, we live in like a 600 square foot apartment. We just didn't have a shop or anything for women at the time. So I'm like, I just ordered, you know, tens of thousands of dollars of parts. They're going to come in on pallet, and we have no place to store them. So we're going to have to take our bed apart and put it up against the wall and just sleep on the couch for a few months until we get this figured out. No lie, we've got pictures of like just stacks of cardboard boxes and pallets in this tiny apartment in South Minneapolis. Thankfully, now we have like a workshop with like equipment and stuff like that, so I don't have to store stuff. For a long time, it was just basically I got an engineering closet in my computer, and on the weekends, I would just hack on these projects and find people who wanted to buy them. So I had some kids, got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, and honestly, between all the stuff I like to do, I find it hard to do full product development on my own time. So what I do now for Wayne is we do museum exhibits. Design. So a lot of museums have interactive installations that have either screens, like so this one isn't too physical computing. This has got some iPads and some screens and some buttons. But then there's stuff like this, which is where you've got to balance it to teach kids about how there's no real storage in the power here. So you've got a demand side and the supply side. And as like the sun comes up and the time of day and air conditioning comes on, things like that, the demand changes. And the kids here have to both like turn on the coal plant and I think that's two coal pieces. There's like hydropower, which like fills this dam up, and then you can only drain so much. There's a solar power that works on the sun, and it's kind of just this interactive piece, but it's got an Arduino in there or something like that, and a lot of motors and stuff. It's unbelievably fulfilling because they're all one-off. And so it's almost the opposite pressures of making product stuff. When I make something like this, I'm shaving every possible penny off because every single penny that I save gets multiplied by 5 or 10 or something. And then ends up, if I change the LED and it now costs 0.012 cents compared to 0.011 cents or something, that ends up affecting the end price and that affects the money itself. But on something like this, where they're only making one of these, a lot of the times it's like if you want to switch your part out for a part that's $10 more, it's not a problem. And that's not something you can ever pick with for something you put on the top. Like there's no part in the iPhone like they would say, we'll pick the one that's $10 more. Like there's just not space in the price there to do that. Like we've also done projects like this, which is for Seattle. I think the University of Washington, Seattle. They put weight scales inside of these trash cans. And when you throw garbage or recycling or compost away, it weighs exactly how much that was down to like the tenth of the gram. And then tells you like when you threw that away in the garbage bin, if everybody threw that much away every day, it would cost us this much to have all this pollution in landfill size. And by putting it in recycling, you make money on recycling. So you just save for you $X thousand per year if you do it. They actually spun it off into a startup, and there's people doing this full time. Screens like this. This is something where the inside of this is these 3 Raspberry Pis inside of here, which are like these little $35 computers. They've got some I/O pins, kind of like a microcontroller, but they also have HDMI and SD cards. And so these are just fancy videos. And then we pause the video and bring up this like spinny weight scale thing when you throw it away. So what is, for weight and labor, what does it look like when we do this prototyping? Because realistically, even though we ship these to customers, they're prototypes. We're only making one of them because a lot of times the outside of them are expensive enough and just material. So we're making a really good prototype that then we polish up enough to ship. So what does that look like today? Well, the guts of it are probably a Raspberry Pi, which are off-the-shelf microcontrollers or small computers. We designed, like if we need a PCB, if we need to make a circuit board for these, maybe KiCad, maybe Altium. We like KiCad a lot. We actually work on making awesome, like it's this open PCB layout tool. There's also CAD stuff, so sometimes we'll do exposures. Sometimes we'll do 3D printing. Sometimes we'll do laser cutting, or even like almost all of this stuff is CNC. Like that right there, that's a whole bunch of CNC files. This one here, not so much, but still some. And then the top three are like the guts of what it like what's inside of it. But then what's running on it is like also free software. So Linux. And then if we have a web component, like the weight scales actually uploaded the information timestamps of the garbage and everything off to the internet on like a sheet on a drive, like a spreadsheet. And the fact is like it used to be that like to run like even 10 years ago to run a server on the internet, like a program you want to run I mean, it's really amazing how $5 a month or less free sometimes, if you have yourself like real computers on the internet that you can use and just upload programs to without needing to buy in. Like, you know, 20 years ago, if you made a PCB, but they're talking $10,000 of just software for your computer. And then once you've designed it, what's your minimum order of making PCBs? Probably a few panels. You've got to drop another, you know, 10 grand in just ordering this stuff. And today, with all the tools we have, a person can make a video on the internet for a few hundred dollars if they've got the training and kind of the knowledge. So outside of that, how did I actually pay the bills when I was working on, when I was learning how to make these exhibits? So after I left Lockheed Martin, I started at DG. They are a company outside or out of Minneapolis that does in electronics mostly tailored for industry. So this is, we're talking about, they do like storage and refrigeration control. They'll have modules that you put like at Chipotle, for example, after they have all their scares and all their like salmonella issues. Like the answer to that from a PR perspective is like, well, we did all our training and then we put this little microcontroller on each one of the like on all the steps of the food and in all the refrigerators, and it'll tell us if a person has the door of the refrigerator open and it's in an unsafe area, we get an alert and we get told this. Or water tank levels or just tank levels we still, like in general, we want to know, you know, how high is the water level, how high is the coolant level, all these things. And it's really surprising all these kind of niche industries that need electronics and need to be hooked up, but don't think of what necessarily what they think of engineering. One of the things I say is that like a lot of the ways that an engineer is able to make a lot of impact is that engineering is not evenly spread out throughout the world. Like there are still projects and products out there that if we look at it with our engineering eyes, we're like, this is completely obsolete and this is ridiculous. Like I'm thinking of like, I worked on a project, you know, quite a few years ago, that at the time they had to ship a laptop with it because they weren't able to keep the local electronics up to date and it used like an obsolete technology to hook up the computers. Nobody had those computers anymore. And so they had to buy a massive amount of these 386 laptops that had like this connection on them in order to work with that product. And as engineers, we look at it and we're like, if you sell this product that has $100 of parts in it for $1,000, why don't you spend some time to use that money to re-engineer it to work with something modern? And a lot of times, it's because not everybody is an engineer. Not everyone looks at it from that perspective. And a lot of times people look at it and just say, it still works. Like, what do you mean? Like, until it becomes a disaster because they're out of laptops and they can't buy anymore, and now they don't have a product. So there's this kind of back and forth between finding that group of people that have domain expertise, but not engineering expertise, and there's massive potential there because they have a problem. The project I'm thinking about was actually like, it's for weight training. It was a way to map where the bar was in weight training live in order to get like the dirt and acceleration and everything for your weight training. But if you think about it from first principle, like sure we can do this with, I think it had ultrasound, like it's a beacon or an infrared beacon or something like that. We did time of flight on the ultrasound in order to triangulate bilaterally where it is. But at the same point, they didn't have engineers on staff to say, hey, we should keep this up to date. So what is design services? So I've been working in that for about 8 years, and I had no idea what that was when I was in college. A modern electronics design company, like they do RF hardware, they probably do RF because nearly everything today has a radio in it. Who wants to plug stuff in? Like the people who buy things, they don't want to plug. So you've got hardware, you've got people doing PCB layout, you've got people doing antenna layout and antenna testing. You've got firmware, so that's the software that runs on the microcontrollers and radios and stuff that you have. You've got firmware expertise. And then kind of as you go down this list, you don't necessarily have all of these opportunities at every firm. So other things we have today are like Android apps, iOS app expertise. That's kind of like its own type of programming. Like you'll have web services, which are, that's like to make it so that it can talk to the internet. They have to have a thing on the internet to talk to. UX and UI, which is what the business people will throw out. And that just means like thinking about the customer, thinking about people when you're designing your product, as compared to thinking about just technical requirements or like engineering acumen and like impressive, clever problem solving. Then you move into things like mechanicals and enclosures. It's kind of weird, but most of these places don't have anyone on staff who knows CAD or can actually do any enclosure design. So a lot of times that gets farmed out to a company that just does mechanicals. And I can say that that's a huge opportunity there, because when I think about projects that I've worked on that have been disasters, a lot of times it's because of the communication between design services and mechanicals sometimes goes so poorly that the customer will actually start working on the like final plastic, they'll call it, before you even made the guts. So you know exactly how big something is and where it can plug in. And then they say, well, what does technology allow and what does technology need? And you're like, it's just not going to fit. And when the business folks are like, well, we already bought the molds and made a bunch of them, it's now it's another level of engineering problem to solve. And that's one that like no customer will appreciate. So to me, I really like to save like the waistband engineering saves for things that make the product really awesome. And things where it's just because they went out of order, like why waste your engineering expertise on something like that? And then you get kind of other stuff like, I don't know how much Internet of Things is kind of in like infiltrated like regular society outside of like design services, where I hear people say this like 3 or 4 times a day. But the idea that so like let's say I work on a project that puts a random thing on the internet, like a water bottle. You've got your water bottle now that puts it to the internet and it will tell you you're not hydrated. I'm sure this exists. I don't know of one. I haven't worked on them personally. But so a person has an idea. They say, okay, this is great. This is probably doable based on my idea of what technology is. But then there's the idea of like, okay, so if you're going to make a bunch of these, how are you going to fund it? Once you have this infrastructure, it's no longer like the days of I make a product, like say a water bottle that beeps at you. I don't need to pay any money after I sell you. I sell you this water bottle that beeps. Then you take the water bottle and the batteries are dead and you replace them. And then it doesn't matter. But now, it goes to the internet and it can email you and it'll post on your Facebook wall when you've done a really good job drinking every day. All these silly features, right? But what that means then is that there has to be engineering resources on this product even after they've purchased it. So they purchased this water bottle that was on the internet, this super water bottle feature. And now when Facebook just changes their mind for no reason and says, well, the way that you post on walls is different. Now every one of your products is broken until you spend some time to make that work. So it kind of changes the relationship when you buy things. It seems so silly that just putting something on the internet is so changes everything about how you do product design. But now you've got two options. One is you make it really good at launch and you don't touch it again, which is what happened normally for products before Internet of Things. Is you'd make it, and if you wanted to make a new one, you'd make a version 2 and make them buy it again. And so without that, now like you have an option of making it really good at the beginning and then not maintaining it, and it just breaks a little bit more every day. And then why would they buy something else from you, because you have this reputation of this broken product? Or you have to keep it up. And by keeping it up, that means you have engineering resources. So how much money are you really making on this water bottle? And stuff forever? Probably not. So are you now going to charge a subscription fee for your water bottle? Like, how does this whole thing work? And so a lot of times we're actually brought in and they ask us to vet their like business model. Like, we're not VCs, we're not people who do this for life, but at the same point, we get to see so many projects that we can say, this doesn't smell right, guys. Like, are you sure? So what do people come to design services for? Like, why do they not just hire an engineer, right? So in terms of the questions we get asked, I thought about maybe the projects I've worked on over the last 2 to 3 months. And then how do you fall into these categories? Which is somebody coming to us and saying, you know, we've got this idea. Is it even possible? Like, are you able to make a demo of this thing? Is this even possible? The next is this a good idea? Which is a completely different question than is it even possible? And rarely are we actually asked if it's a good idea. The next is like, I have an amazing idea and I have a little bit of money. And I want you to make me a demo. And then I'm going to use it to get a lot of money in San Francisco. Or the next is, okay, so I did that. So now I have an amazing idea, guys, and I know it's amazing, but I have to get a whole bunch of money. Now we gotta actually do it. I don't have any engineers, so I need your help. Or I did this, I made this thing, I made a super water bottle, but I need to make version 2. And I don't have an engineer. So can you help me make version 2? Just a lot of ideas. Or this happens a lot of times in larger organizations, where larger organizations will come to us and say, we want an outside perspective on this. Most of our engineers, like we're a good engineering firm, most of our engineers have been working here for 10, 20 years, and they know how we do things, but we want to see an outside perspective so we can provide that in design services as well. And then there's the other thing, the kind of the last one, which is, you know, we've got everything going, it's all good, but we have some delays, and we're behind, so we just need some extra engineering hands. So we, like, in terms of engineers who can enter a new project, it's already in place, you got no training outside of what you bring yourself. And can you help us bring this, like, the end game forward? We want to get this out of the system. We're not on track for that. We need extra money. That's kind of the last tool. So then why? So this slide plays two roles. So this is, it's really clever, and I kind of actually didn't realize this when making this slide, which is why design services is a question from both. Why would a company go to design services, but then also why would you work in design services? So one reason is that you get an experience across the full product development process. So a lot of times when you work in a larger engineering firm, it may take 3 years to get a product built. So that means you have to work there for 3 years to see the start, the middle, and the end of making a product. When you work in a more project-based thing like design services, like you might be working on 3 projects at the same time, and you might be at the beginning, the middle, and the end, all in 2 months of different projects. The other is that I never worry about only learning one industry. I mean, every single product I work on is completely different. I might work on infusion pumps for blood infusion pumps for one day. I may work on Internet of Things water bottle the next day, or like a taxi fare cab meter. Like I work in a whole new like a whole new industry every month at least. And kind of the same idea as earlier when I said that we've got this outside perspective on something. We have that idea of we are a more diverse group of engineers than the group of engineers that you hired at your company that has been working there for a long time. Simply because we work on so many different things. So by working on so many different things, it like the reason why diversity is so important in engineering is that the wider the base of ideas that you get, the higher the chances are that you'll find like the optimum idea. If everybody has always done things the same way, what if you have done the next product is going to be pretty low. So there's that like the viewpoint and diversity. And then like the last one is why I kind of quote you because I hate saying this. But a lot of organizations looking at engineers are really expensive. And a lot of times they're kind of right. Because if you only need a
third of an engineer for your project over a year, you can't just hire a third of an engineer. It's pretty hard to find engineers who want to work like part time for a company every single day. So there's that whole idea that you have a staff engineer is expensive. It's expensive with all the things on it. Hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to have an engineering department is at the low end, all the way to, I don't know, infinity dollars at the high end. And so that's kind of the other reason too, is that working in a design, like in engineering for me, has meant that I can do engineering for fun outside of my day job and be okay with it, because engineers are expensive, which means also engineers get paid a lot. So there's that piece. So then what does it look like in this full product development cycle? Because I figure, a lot of people are wondering, is this something like what type of product are you really making in design? Like who would not want a whole engineering? And I mean, we're not making iPhones, but at the same point, you'd be really surprised like what type of products are going to make kind of with this process. Like, this is not the most complicated project we do in design services. Like, here's one of the most scrappiest ways that you can go. But realistically, it's 2019. If you want to make a product, you'd be really surprised how far a person can get. By starting off with these, like a pre-made board that you load your software on, and you get it as far as you can until you can't get that pre-made board anymore. At which point, you make your own PCB. You lay it out, it might cost you a few $1,000s for layout, and then you go and order it from, say, MacroFab or some sort of PCBA like manufacturer. That might cost you a few hundred to a few thousand, depending on how big and complicated the thing is. And then when you get it back, you do board bring up, which means you make sure that your PCB works. And then once you've done that, you load your software back in, you finish it off, and then you send it off. It's kind of surprising how little time that people in design like services start with like a blank schematic and then go from, okay, I need some resistors and I need to do this, as compared to how often you start out with an example and then you tweak the example until it works. Something that was kind of really depressing to me when I got into industry, actually, that I assumed that I would be starting with, like, all right, I gotta bring this thing up from these manuals. I got these big manuals from the chip manufacturer, and I gotta bring it up. I wish that happened more often, but so much more of the time, people start with an example, and then, well, okay, so I need to get the example board, or I need to add a light sensor, or I need to add some load cells, or I need some good ADCs on there, and go from there. But anyway, like over the past few years, there's been a huge amount of change. So when I started in, say, 2009, 10 years ago or so, the big thing design services was doing for electronics was, like everything went on the 2G radio for cell. So you would take whatever thing needed a little bit of data. This is just the very start of this Internet of Things, where you're like, I've got this handheld computer that someone will buy just for my application. The first thing I ever worked on was a PDA that was meant exclusively for people who golf. And it would tell you what hole, from where you were and what hole you were going to. It would tell you which club you needed. It was like a virtual club. And this thing was like $400, and then you had to pay like $30 a month for it. And I know everybody here is like, that would probably be enough today. And that's kind of which is the next step, which is the iPhone came in, and it used to be that people were okay spending $150,000 for people to throw a cellular radio on something, and that was the project. And it was just this big backlog of all the electronics on the planet needed a cellular radio on it. And it was, $150,000 to $300,000 for that project. And that was a good chunk of projects for a long time. The iPhone comes along and people's expectations start to grow. And so when people's expectations grow, then business expectations grow as well. So when I've got this $400 e-cam that I could pay $30 a month for. And then the iPhone comes out that's maybe $500 or something that also needs like a cell plan. You look at it and you're like, the iPhone is so polished and so wonderful. And this e-cam has the chunkiest screen and it looks like it could withstand combat scenarios. And it's like, it's not smooth or sleek or anything. And the entire industry changed because all the way from consumers to businesses didn't realize that the way Apple designs products is not the way that nearly anyone can design products. There's this great anecdote of they did, I think it was that with the iPhone 5 when they made it all like waterproof, was their big deal that year. The way they made it so waterproof is all the speaker holes in it were done with laser micro drilling in the case. And these laser holes, I don't think I'm exactly right on mechanical, but I believe that the laser holes are small enough that air and sound could get through, but they're deep enough that water can't really get through because of surface tension or capillary or opposite capillary action or something. Where basically you can't transmit water through, but it's still like pretty clear to sound. And when they did this, they bought up all the world's on the machines that can do the laser micro drill. But then they also bought all the companies that make the laser micro drill machines. So they literally had a world monopoly on laser micro drilling for a few pieces. And that's something where there's probably five companies in the world who can engineer at that scale. So people have expectations of, I'm going to buy this $400 thing, $500 thing, it's going to have, how many people are working on each individual aspect of the iPhone. Like I know each Kindle has over 200 firmware engineers working on it. And so when you think about what that costs and the scale you have to run your operations, so the iPhone was this big like scope change for everything. Every project now, like I'm expecting it's as good as an iPhone, but I'm going to pay you 1% of what the iPhone costs to develop. Then after that, kind of there's a swing back to Raspberry Pi and Arduino and off-the-shelf electronics, where a lot of the projects that we do as a demo, if the project you're making isn't for production, but instead is for a sample to show people your idea, why not do something nearly off-the-shelf inside it? So there's that kind of the Raspberry Pi and Arduino shift up back to where expectations are higher, but what you get for free is now also higher. So then it kind of shifted back again with this ecosystem, which is like, so that's the idea that a solid product that launches today isn't just a product. It ties into everything else, right? So it can send email and it talks to your Facebook wall and it's got a Bitmoji screen on the front that ties into your active lifestyle. It's like a product can't be simple and be released without kind of being tricky. So then that's once again, that's kind of back and forth where now you're not just making a product, you're making an ecosystem. And then there's this whole Internet of Things idea, which is where we put everything on the internet or a network in order to get intelligence out of it, in order to make people do less work by themselves. Then that's something where kind of that's a both ways where what you get off the shelf is now increased because people understand these demands. But now, what does that mean for the minimum level of product? It now costs the internet, probably. So then, the rise of 3D printing, which I've been, a huge fan of 3D printing for a lot of years, even when it was not really a serious thing, but more like a jokey, like, look at this, I can make a cube in my house for, a few $100 of my time, and it almost looks decent looking until you pick it up and the layers come apart. Into where, like, today, most of the case prototypes we get, it completely changed how we prototype cases. Because it's no longer a thing where we don't even go to like finish mechanicals until the end. It's the case of, sure, we're almost all of these projects now have a case from nearly the beginning, but it's 3D printed, and then they sand it and bond it. It's not really 3D printed, but at the same point, it looks and feels then, so that's a case where, you know, like the arrow of easy to hard is swinging the other way. Then bring your own device is something that's super awesome, which is where we don't need a $400 standalone Ghost computer anymore. Like, imagine if that thing didn't need some hardware. Like, let's say the one that I worked on actually didn't have a tag that you put on into your clumps. And so when you pulled your clumps out of your case, it would tell that it had been exposed to light, and then it would ping and say whether or not you pulled the right club up. So now, today, if we were to do that, that would be a peripheral for your phone. So you wouldn't be having to buy your own standalone Ghost system. Instead, you use your regular phone. Instead of having an MCAP for your golf clubs that would then make, oh, no, you pulled the wrong one out. You know, pull the other one out. So the rise of bring your own device means that so much more people aren't recreating a wheel with every single product. Because it's expensive. It's environmentally wasteful. Like that was one of the ones that really got me. It's like, if you're buying a new golf computer every single year that's got all these, you know, capacitors and this and that, and then you're just throwing it away at the end of the year to buy the next year's golf courses. Like, this really should be something that, you know, like you already have a phone. Let's reuse the computing power inside of that phone and just make it better. So it's kind of the back and forth there. But then, when I think about this stuff quite a lot, actually, because I kind of want to be one step ahead and I kind of want to be where we're going instead of constantly chasing where we're at. And so to me, it's like, what's next for design services, right? Like, open source hardware is a thing that I've been involved with since forever, realistically. And so that's the idea that I might make a schematic and I might make a hardware product, and I can release all of the plans and all of the parts and all of the details about it for free on the internet. And anybody who wants to modify it, I say, I'm okay with you modifying it. As long as if you then make your modifications, if you then release your modifications kind of the same agreement that I did. So there's that kind of like idea that I'll share all my intellectual property, or maybe just the parts I don't like, whatever, I just pick. And I share that, and then anyone can use it as long as they share their modification. So to me, this is something that is a cultural thing. Things aren't done the same in the US as they are done in other countries, not only legally, but culturally. But it's also something that I really hope it continues to grow. There's already companies that do, there's a laptop, a full laptop is relatively decent, that is completely open source hardware. They also released the Librem 5, which is a phone that's completely open source hardware. I think there's one part of the baseband radio that connects to the tower that isn't open source because there are no open source baseband radios, but outside of that, the whole thing is all open top to bottom. The next question is, like, how big do you need to be successful? So there's this trend where 15 years ago, like, we needed to have a good chunk of people in order to do design services. And every year, it seems like it's a lower and lower number of people. Like, in fact, if you think about what me and one other guy are doing with this, like, I mean, we didn't do the enclosures for these, but this is like a full product that people are paying tens of thousands of dollars for. And it's literally just two people. So what does that mean that what comes off the shelf is closer and closer to being a full product? And now you're integrating these pieces together instead of doing it from first principles every time. What does that mean for both team size? And what does that mean for the industry altogether, when if you know a company hires one of you guys for the summer and you can make a full demo that can impress VC enough to invest, what does that mean for design services? Is that even something we should be providing anymore? Like, is there value there anymore when a person is, you know, oh yeah, we know this shop guy, the same way the small shop rooms have IT that's just like a guy they hire out every once in a while or a person that they hire out? What happens when small scale engineering is kind of the same thing? Like, what happens when a person's like, you know what? What I need in my dry cleaning business is a way to automatically check if this ink is empty. What happens when that's not like a complicated project? but instead it's ordering three things off Amazon and slapping maybe 100 lines of Python. Like, what does that mean for all of electronics and also society when engineering spends kind of, like, I don't want to say, like, when it's been widespread, when we bring those barriers down, what does that mean? Like, what does that mean for the fact that all the people who aren't in engineering because of life or because of biases and things like that, like, what does it mean when engineering is so much easier to do things that are impressive that, you know, like me, I think about that quite a lot. And then I also think, kind of selfishly, like, what's next for engineers? Like, what does that mean for me? Like, what does that mean for me in my career? That, like, I, you know, in 10 years, I have no doubt that you'll be able to throw together and even have a thing, a device for $100 and a weekend of engineering. What does that mean? Like, what do I need to do to stay up in the game when that level is so much lower? So that's all I've got here. I'm kind of all over the internet. I've got fun projects and blog posts and things. And I'd love to hear your thoughts. And I think there's some questions.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.